Hello and welcome to the Robert A. Heinlein Book Club. In this episode, I will talk about Double Star by Heinlein. And I know we've been sitting with the juveniles for quite a while, and we got a few more of those to cover, but we are kind of entering into the study of Heinlein's more middle works and his more adult works, and I'm really excited for that. I think you know, I think I've said kind of what can be said about the juveniles. I still have two more to read. I don't think they'll change my overall perspective of them, but you know, a book like this kind of is a palate cleanser in respect to those juveniles, and you know, kind of sets us up for what I think are like a really different tone shift and different things we're going to do in those later books. So I'm just going to spend one episode on this. I don't know quite how long this is in comparison to the juveniles. It's definitely shorter. The Library of America version I have is 147 pages. So yeah, this episode is kind of a crossover. This is technically, this could fit under the 100 pages at a time rubric because it is a Library of America text. So if I ever go back and do the American Science Fiction novel collection, which I think is up to four volumes, plus I think there's, yeah, I think it's four volumes now. You know, which would be fun to do at some point, but you know, this would be the down payment on that. I would just refer to this episode for it. But anyways, shorter than the juveniles. Another thing to say about this is it's barely a science fiction novel. That's what I remembered going into it, and after rereading it, I think that's essentially true. There are science fiction elements in the story. There's two. One is the Martian relationship. There are Martians, and the plot is about a political candidate who is trying, he's a member of the expansionist party. So he wants to see humanity interact in the space. His name's John Joseph Bonfort, and his goal is to expand the human influence in place in the solar system. But to do that, he realizes they're going to have to like work with other species and not be xenophobic, which is in contrast to like the Earth Firsters candidate. So Bonfort's the more liberal, open-minded candidate, but he's also the more expansionist. He's the one who wants his humanity into space. He just thinks to do that requires working with others. And the centerpiece then of the plot that we get in the story is that Bonfort is about to be joined into a Martian tribe that he's been interacting with and working with for quite a while. So that is going to be the first step in kind of bringing the Martians into like the essentially the Federation. So that's a science fiction concept, of course, and certainly the prejudice towards the Martians. And these are the Martians from like Stranger in a Strange Land or Red Planet that we've met before. Like if you remember the water ceremony from Red Planet and like Willis and how he grows up to be a female and the, you know, and they're very in-grouped focused, ritual focused, you know, the whole process of bringing someone into the tribe. Now there's a little bit of a contrast in Red Planet. The character, whatever his name was, that boy, that rando boy that all those juveniles have, was brought into it pretty abruptly. He was, I guess, because he had the relationship with Willis. That's why he was brought in. But it was a very rapid introduction to the tribe. Bonfort has to do it after the end of a long process of training and learning the language a little bit. Anyways, you get the sense it's part of a long process of trust building. Anyways, my point about all this is, yes, it's science fiction in that sense. But it could have just as easily been some kind of other ethnic group on Earth, right? It could be an American politician trying to reach out to the Soviets or something. It could be anything like that. But yeah, so it's not crucial to the story. The second would be our main character, Lorenzo, the great Lorenzo Smythe is his name, but he has different names throughout because he's an actor. he's prejudiced against Martians. So to do this job, he has to be deprogrammed. And so that he uses like this you know, kind of hypnosis psychology stuff to wash him of his deep hypnosis, to wash him of his prejudice. We've seen that before in Heinlein stories, I think. It's something he was interested in, something he thought sort of could work. It seems very pseudoscientific from our standpoint, but in any case, that is an aspect too. And then you have a spaceship, you know, but outside of that, there's not much core to the plot that's central, which is, it's interesting that the closest we have to real adaptation of this, that I've seen anyways, is Dave, which is just about a body double who ends up taking over as U.S. president for a short period of time. And that's different because in Double Star, of course, Lorenzo becomes Bonforth. He becomes the politician and the leader after Bonforth dies. So he just takes over this role. And so the theme here is, it's actually very much like could be read maybe not quite as a transgender thing, but thematically it's in that ballpark, is because it's something that Heinlein's apparently very interested in, is that people taking on the role they've sort of been assigned, and that becomes who they are, right? Like Lummix becoming the one who raises the generations of that family's children. That's not kind of Lummix's original purpose. It just becomes Lummix's job and central identity over time, right? And I think there's something in the juveniles quite a lot about growing up is taking on a role that might be a little bit different from what you saw for yourself, right? But we'll keep our eyes open for this theme in some of the more adult novels. I think in Starship Troopers you have a bit of it too. As I recall, he joins up with the mobile infantry for citizenship, for patriotism in a way, but then he actually becomes part of that. It becomes something more over time. But anyways, it's just something I'm going to think about and watch about as we go forward here, because I think the flexibility of identity is something that Heinlein is pretty fascinated with, and it just dealt with quite directly in this book. So, but really, there's not much that you... This doesn't need to be a science fiction novel, I guess is the point I'm making. It is, because Heinlein wrote it, and he was marketing it as a science fiction novel. But it's really not that important to the story. So the book is 10 chapters. I didn't take like chapter-by-chapter notes, but I think I can probably remember what happens roughly in the chapters if I go through those. So we're first... Now, this is all first-person narration, which is something he doesn't always do. I think there's... Like, I guess Time for the Stars has a first-person narration because that's like a memoir by our main character there. The juveniles generally aren't first-person narration. There might be a few stories that we've seen that, but generally not. And it does pretty good job of getting us to this head of this character, and we learn quite a lot about his backstory, what motivates him to be his actor, his relationship with his father. And right away, like, I want to say something like, the juveniles, the characters are boring. I've said it again and again. The main character is boring. And Heinlein's capable of writing interesting main characters. He's capable of writing interesting characters. So even the juveniles, there's interesting characters around the main character. Unfortunately, like this proves, the main character can be pretty fascinating too, and fully drawn and have like, and be pretty engaging. Not that those characters don't have pasts and histories and motivations and things like that, like Lorenzo does. It's just you like being in Lorenzo's head. You like him carrying you on with this adventure, and you enjoy being there. You're not like bored being in there waiting for the character to talk to someone else, because that's going to be more interesting than just sticking in that guy's head or what he's doing. So Heinlein's capable of that. I just think young boys, I guess, like young men are maybe kind of boring to me. That might be. It might just be a personal thing. Or the way Heinlein sees them or presents young men is in kind of a boring way. Maybe because they're all kind of science nerds that, you know, they're the kind of kids who should get wedgies or something. Lorenzo is kind of fun. He's kind of fun to watch. You know, we meet him. He's down and out. He's very pretentious. He very much has a high opinion of himself. And you wonder when you're first reading it, like, where does he get this from? Because he apparently, in a material sense, looks like he's not a very successful actor. He looks kind of pathetic. He's living in, like, these hourly rental places. It's a Philip Dick thing where he has to, like, you pay for the door. But I guess this, I don't know who came up with it first. This was what year? I mean, by this point, Philip Dick's already writing, but 56. So I don't think we see Philip Dick's, paying the door by the hour or whatever to open until later. So, you know, Heinlein, let's provisionally give him some credit for that idea. But the signs are that he's just a down and out actor. Now, he's very pompous about his acting ability. He often talks about this, and there's a lot of thought that goes into just what being an actor actually is. Like how it's about the walk, how it's not even about how much you look, that you can put on a role, you can change your face, but a big part of being an actor and acting a role is the poise, the presentation, the dress, the voice. I listened to the audiobook of this, and I think the actor, voice actor, who's done a lot of Heinlein works, he does a pretty good job here of Smythe's internal dialogue being this little bit snotty, full of himself actor. But when he's acting as Bonforth throughout, it's this low, practical, you know, personable, a little bit charismatic voice. He's an entirely different person, right? So the trick here, or the twist, is that you think when you first introduce him that this guy's kind of annoying. He's like he's like an overly trained Shakespearean actor almost, who can't get a job in Hollywood, but he still walks around like with his nose in the air because he thinks he's better than all like the Jennifer Lawrence types who make all the big bucks. And there's some of that in the story. But you learn very on that a couple things. One is he's very much a believer in the art. He very much believes in the principles of old-fashioned show business. And some of this stuff doesn't even feel like it comes from the 50s. It feels like it comes maybe from old vaudevillian kind of values, like the show must go on no matter what, right? That kind of value. Like no matter how bad it's going, you kind of stick it through. The attitude towards the audience, the attitude of always being in character when you need to be in character. The performance, like the morality of the actor's duty. This stuff seems to be like really old-fashioned vaudevillian stuff, maybe even farther back. And it's kind of fascinating to watch, but you do get this sense early on when you meet him that this guy really seems full of himself and you don't really believe him to be a good actor. I mean, he calls himself the Great Lorenzo, which is kind of hacky, right? Maybe not at the time. Maybe it's just from our perspective 70 years later looking at this. When he first interviews for the job, his attitude is like, you know, here I got a quote here right on the page I'm on. Who do you think I am, a bellman or an untried juvenile anxious for the privilege of carrying a spear? I am Lorenzo. I threw up my chin and looked offended. What is your offer? It's like really annoying and kind of gross almost. And it's cringy throughout. At least it was for me. I don't know if that's what Heinlein intended, but like to think he did here. But then when he takes on the job of being Bonforth, we learn he's actually good at this. He's actually an amazing actor. And he doesn't even fully 100% look like Bonforth. He's like 20 years younger. He doesn't have quite the same facial features, but he's able to like slip into that role like into a glove. And it's all about his poise. So much so that like his secretary, Bonforth's secretary, who knows this is an actor, ends up like falling for him, you know, just taking him on as the new Bonforth after Bonforth eventually dies. I'm getting ahead of the story here, but anyways, we meet Lorenzo, and yeah, he's a little pretentious, but he's down on his luck. Then he gets this call to be invited for a job, and he says his fee is like 100 space bucks a day, and they immediately pay him that. And he goes there, And like his attitude towards money throughout this is fascinating too, because he's super, super poor at the beginning, right? But he still has this very principled idea of negotiating and bargaining and his pay. Like he's got that pay per day and he won't take anything less than that. That's of course standard. Even if he's hard on his, having hard times, like he wants $100 just to meet with them because he considers that work. They pay. But then later on, when they ask about pay or when pay comes up, he's always like, well, I'm sure I'll get an honorarium that's commensurate with my performance. Or even when he's like long-term settling into this job as Boneforth after he dies, it's kind of like, I'm sure I'll be paid adequately. Like he's, I don't know if that's a true actor thing. Like that's the agent's job. Like the agents will talk about that. Lorenzo doesn't really have an agent, but at least I don't think we see one. Yeah, I think it's mentioned he has some sort of agent, but not a major part of the story. But the idea that somehow talking about pay is below him is just another kind of fascinating aspect of his character and this image, this portrayal of the actor. I don't know if by this point Heinlein had any experience with actors, because I know he did some film stuff. Like Destination Earth, right, was a film he did. Anyways, he meets with them, this guy Dubois, and I'm not going to remember all these characters' names, but they basically tell him that the job's going to be like some kind of body double kind of job. And he immediately is like, that's not acting. I'm not going to do that. That's beneath me. But he eventually changes his mind. There's a little bit of a side plot here where they get kind of caught up with a Martian, and we learn about his Martian prejudices, his hatred for Martians. And his hatred is like visceral. It's like he can't stand their smell. He can't stand how they look. He's like disgusted by them, which apparently other humans have that same attitude. Others are more liberal and open-minded about the Martians, but Smythe very much hates the Martians, but he's involved in an assassination kind of attempt and covering up, hiding the body of the Martian body, like the one that was killed in the scuffle. And that kind of gets him mixed up with this group, with these people stuck with them. But he eventually takes the job. And in chapter two, he's going to Mars. And during the trip to Mars, he learns about the job and he learns about what he has to do. And so several things take place. One is we learn more about how his background as an actor. He learns a lot from his father. His father was an actor. Father told him the trade. So he's got these deep roots in the values of acting, right? And so the fact that he becomes Boneforth at the end, right? When this much of the effort in his background seems to be about acting, about the job, about the performance, but the performance always ends, right? But by the end, we're told the performance doesn't end. So what happens to an actor who the performance doesn't end? He loses his self-identity. He just becomes the thing he's in. If you're fully ensconced in it, which is what his father teaches him, like when you're acting as Hamlet, you are Hamlet, right? You're 100% Hamlet while you're on stage. If you're never off stage, right, you never slip back into your old role. So in a sense, this is written like a memoir. And I don't know if that's a little bit of a mistake or if we're supposed to think of too much about this, but this isn't written by Smythe. This isn't written by the great Lorenzo. This is written by Boneforth, in a sense. But that's almost be a smarter way to write it. And Heinlein doesn't quite do this. So I'm kind of, there's a little bit of a criticism here. But this should be Boneforth writing the memoir of Lorenzo, like his old self, because the great Lorenzo's dead. He makes this point, the very first line of the story, actually. If a man walks in dressed like a hick and acting as if he owned the place, he's a spaceman. It's a logical necessity. You are how you behave. You are how you act. Therefore, if you speak in this voice and you walk in this way and you portray yourself a certain way and you say these things and you give these speeches that way, you are Boneforth. Right, you are not. It's not like obviously he can act as a spaceman, but that's not what we're told here. If a man dresses like a hick and acts if he owned the place, he's a spaceman. Lorenzo knows he could be a spaceman. In fact, he calls out these people as spacemen because he sees how they carry themselves, and he's able to carry themselves the same way. He talks about tricks, like you can put rocks in your shoes, right? Or or whatever. He's got all the little tricks to help the performance, involving even things like how you walk. So I don't know if I'm reading too much into this, but I think that's how I want to read it, that this is Bonforth writing about Lorenzo. Maybe it's Bonforth writing from the perspective of a time he was Lorenzo, but he's not anymore. Clearly, by the end of the story, he is Bonforth permanently forever. He's always on stage. Which, I don't know if that's like a nightmare for an actor. Like, do actors have nightmares where they're like always on stage and they can never get off and they can never like go back into their old skin, that they're always in the character skin? You know, obviously we have in Stephen King several stories in which the fear of being the pen name, right? Being Richard Stark, being, what's the one, Secret Window, where he, you know, he almost becomes the alter ego of the writer, right? Or you become your characters. There's that, there's this wonderful short story written in the early 2000s, I think, or maybe the late 90s, where an English college professor who writes novels in his spare time, in summers, writes one pulp novel under a pseudonym. He sees a woman being like harassed and beaten in a truck stop bathroom, and he just like unloads on the guy and beats him up. But he has to like slip himself into the persona of the writer of the crime fiction, not the college professor persona. And that's kind of a scary thing. You like lose yourself in that role, right? Now Lorenzo does very smoothly seem to fit into that role, but there's some anxiety about it. There's times where he wants to get back to his regular life as Lorenzo, but when he can't, it's like the show must go on, right? That's the theme of the story here. Again, not science fiction at all. It just, anyways, I keep getting off track here. So as I said, on the ship, a couple things happen. One is they deal with his Martian prejudice by essentially brainwashing him. And he learns, basically he deduces it from the fact that they're having him watch Bonford speeches, that his job is to be a body double for this very famous and often shot at politician Bonforth. So he thinks his job is basically to act as Bonforth during a an assassination attempt, and then to just eat the bullet for Bonforth. That he thinks his job is. So he thinks, you know, he is just like a rental. He's just there to catch the bullet. Now they tell him that's possible, but that's not really going to fit the goals of the extremists on the other party. So again, back to the political situation we have facing here. We have the people in power. Now we have an emperor, right? There's even a scene where Bonforth meets the emperor, or Lorenzo meets the emperor as Bonforth, and he's called out. He's like, "You're not really Bonforth, I can tell." We'll get into that a little bit as well. The politics of this is how politicians manage their relations is an interesting subplot. I think it's drawn from life, but it's laid out here pretty explicitly. The emperor is just like the English king. He just does whatever the ruling party kind of wants. He's just going along with the policy, but the ruling party is the human first type. Now, this is kind of the early days of Earth expansion, kind of green hills of Earth timeline, that period of time. But there is like all these colonies and there's a federation. And the question is, do the Martians join? The expansionists want the Martians to join and want to go off into the sky, see humanity expand. But to do that means going to have like basically like a Star Trek federation with a multi-ethnic. The Earth Firsters are more of the fascists. They just want, they'd rather just stay at home, or if they expand, it's just humans expanding. They don't want to interact with the aliens. Now, Lorenzo's own father is closer to the Earth Firsters. Now, he's not political, but Lorenzo is kind of an Earth Firster. So that's important because he's sliding into the glove of an expansionist. Moving on in the story, he meets Penny. Penny is Bonforth's secretary and lover, and she's very disgusted by him at first because she is, you know, having a relationship with Bonforth. But of course, she wants to help in any way she can, right? Because the hope is that Bonforth will be saved, because that's what happened to him. He got kidnapped by the radicals, who don't want him to go through with this Martian ceremony. Now, why can't they just find him, and why don't they just kill him? Well, if he was killed, he could be posthumously entered into the Martian clan, the family, and that would still be considered legitimate, and he would achieve his goals. If he doesn't show up on time, though, he's making the great faux pas. So we get the background story here of ancient Martian mythology and traditions in which someone comes late to a meeting, and it's like a big offense, and it disrupts the whole political situation, and it's bad news to show up late. So you have to have Bonforth not show up at all, not just kill him. That's why they think, Lorenzo, don't worry, you're not going to be assassinated. It could happen, but probably not. Because they just wanted to kidnap Bonforth until he could, so he wouldn't do the ceremony. So his job, Lorenzo's job, is to fulfill this ceremony, make sure it was done on time, accurately, properly. Maybe he has to do a press conference, but that's the job. And then hopefully by then there's no reason to keep Bonforth locked up, and they'll free him. Penny wants to help with this because she wants to see Bonforth released as well. But the question is, but he still has to deal with his Martian prejudice, because he's going to have to be on Mars with Martians for a long time. So the solution is hypnosis, this deep hypnosis I mentioned before, and it leads to him being, they deal with the smell by making him, whenever he smells Martian, he smells like a fragrance he likes, which is like what Penny wears too, so he associates this good smell with Penny. But it's a good smell. And they also deal with his other visceral hatred of Martians, and he ends up not hating Martians. This seems, maybe there's an anti-racist pill we can give people someday. Or put them in a machine and hypnotize them to be anti-racist. I'm fine with that if we have that, I suppose. I just don't think the psychology there, I don't think holds up. So anyways, eventually they get to Mars. He's got to learn his role. And as they get closer to Mars, he starts slipping more and more into the role of Bonforth, interacting with other people. Even people who know he's Smythe, know he's the great Lorenzo, interacting with him as Bonforth. And he gets quite good at it. He tricks people. Even people that know he's not Bonforth are sort of tricked by him, or at least taken aback by him, or convinced that he can do this. And then he gets to Mars. There's a little bit of prep and stuff going on. But essentially, the most important thing is that he goes to this ceremony, learns a little bit of Martian, which all actors know a little bit of Martian, which is like a bunch of... It kind of reminds me of the Venetian or the Venerian language we saw in Between Planets, where there's kind of like trills and swirls and whistles and things. We get a bit of that here too. But he has to do the ceremony. And this is about halfway through the novel is when this happens. He successfully does it. He does his performance. There's no crowd. There's no cheer. There's no audience, really, except the other Martians who think he's just Bonforth going through this. He even is able to trick the Martian who befriended him initially. But it's like a whole day ritual. He has to say certain words in Martian. He has to go through these different traditions. He had to learn it all, but he does it quite well. Because we learn it by this point, you got to be convinced he's a good actor. He knows what he's doing. Why is he down on his luck at the beginning? I don't know. Maybe the reason a lot of actors are down on their luck. It's just, didn't have the right agent. Getting a little old, not getting the right roles, whatever. And he's kind of a stage actor. I think their careers might be more unstable than like Hollywood actors, the way we think about them. But as we saw in the recent Hollywood strike, like most actors are kind of like just part-time and don't have full health care benefits and all these kinds of things. So anyways, after the ceremony's done, he does a little press conference with the media and regurgitates old Bonforth speeches pretty effortlessly and fits right into the role of the expansionist. The second half of the novel then is you know, what do you do at this point? Well, they find Bonforth, but Bonforth's been like brain damaged and injured during this, and eventually he dies from it. So Bonforth is there in some of the second half of the novel, but he's just there, you know, as maybe there's hope that at some point Lorenzo can go back to his old job, get a big paycheck, maybe retire. But Bonforth never really recovers from this injury. So he keeps getting an extension to the contract, essentially. You know, he resists this and he confronts it. He says, I did the job. I didn't like sign up to meet the emperor. But they're like, no, you have to. You're in this now. All right. You have to stick with us. And so he has to continue his job and he has to like give a speech at one point. He has to meet the emperor. Now I want to talk about the emperor and the how Bonforth does his politics, because I think this is true life. Like, if you've ever seen Veep, you know, there's scenes in that TV show Veep with, you know, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, right, playing the vice president, where she's shaking everyone's hand and there's an aide behind her saying, oh, that guy has a dog named Frank, and that guy's wife is so-and-so. And before every meeting, so she can say, oh, hi, how's your wife so-and-so? How's your dog Frank? That is a trick of politics. Now, how does Bonforth do it? Well, he has just a big Rolodex, essentially, of everyone's name that he's ever met with some tidbits, facts about their life, how many kids they have, their wife, you know, and he tries to update it as much as possible. So he can always have that brief little conversation. Now, do the people who hear these conversations, like if you met the president twice and the second time and you mention your wife, so-and-so, and you meet him 2 months later and he mentions like your wife, you on some level know that's fake, right? You don't believe it, but it still works because he'd had the time to write it down. He took the time to write it down and to review it before he met you a second time. So that itself is kind of endearing to you and makes you feel an affection for that person, that powerful person who took the time to review that little note card or to review your file for 5 seconds before meeting you. And so it still works, even though everyone knows it's sort of fake. Now, Bonforth can't do this with the emperor because there's no file on the emperor. And why isn't there? Well, because Bonforth would remember the emperor because he's the emperor. He's not just a rando low-level politician that he's running into. So he gets trapped by the one person who Bonforth would remember all the details of his conversations with because he's a higher up. I found that kind of a fascinating thing. And it's a little bit of a threat late in the story because by the midpoint, it's not clear what the threat is. Maybe there's an assassination attempt. Maybe, you know, there is those kinds of threats, but what could go wrong, right? All that really is there's an election coming up. There's not much. The tension of can he slip into this role of Bonforth is resolved halfway through the story. He clearly can. He's unrecognizable as Lorenzo anymore. But the emperor sizes him up and smells him out as an imposter, as an actor, because of what he didn't know, which is stuff Bonforth would have just memorized. Really great moment. Wonderful stuff there, I think. Beautifully done. But the emperor is just sort of like, I don't care. It's just like, you know, prime ministers come, prime ministers go. He seems to be fine with it. He thinks this is just part of the job. And he cares about maybe the big politics of it. You know, this is very much like the English monarch. It's just a ceremonial role. It's not one that holds much actual power. So whatever. So he gives this speech, and this leads to the Humanity Party, the Earth Firsters, the government resigning. His speech is that effective that they immediately sort of resign, and there's a crisis of confidence in the government, vote of no confidence kind of thing, and there's the new elections are called. This is very much the English style of government, not the American. For every 2 years, you have a new Congress. So there's going to be an election. So the last part of the book involves like the death of Bonforth and then this new Bonforth taking over the role of running the campaign as Bonforth, you know, Lorenzo running the campaign as Bonforth and winning the election. But with Bonforth's death, he has to then take on the role. So we learn at the end of the story that this is all written like 20 years later, as a memoir by now Bonforth, who's been in power off and on since the victory of this election. And of course, he's wealthy, he's powerful, he's successful. He's younger than Bonforth, so the implication is he's going to be able to live a long time and maintain in politics. He's shacked up with Penny, and he's become the Bonforth. The actor has become the subject because he's never able to get off stage. That's what happens. Pretty good. I think an excellent book. Any criticisms of it? Not really. I just think thematically it would be more interesting if it was Bonforth writing it. And they really hit home much more this idea, this concept that Lorenzo is Bonforth. He's completely slipped into the role. But yeah, does it have to be a science fiction novel? No. Obviously, this has been told in other genres and just like as a political drama, before. But it works. The world building here is fun with the nature of the government and the two major parties and this question about how humanity is going to move forward into the stars. Heinlein's obviously thought about the technology of this throughout the juveniles. Somewhat he's thought of the politics of it all, but I think not as sophisticated as here. This is the best, most well-developed look we've seen in a while of like a political system being established that's not like laughably kind of stupid like in Revolt and 2100. That's kind of silly, over the top, just there like this theocracy where people are just like medieval knights. It's kind of a joke. Sixth Column is kind of ridiculous. It seems realistic that we would get this kind of tension. And the way the political system works with a constitutional monarchy kind of holding this empire together and power shifting between parties, very much based on the British parliamentary system with a prime minister running the state on behalf of the symbolic emperor. The theme of the actor becoming the subject is great, as I said several times. Even taking on the lover of Bonforth, fit into the role and becoming better and better at the role over time so that he's able to maintain power for many years and never get called out. That's great. The last few pages are like a postscript written 25 years later. Oh, maybe that's what's happening. Yeah. Oh, so the first 150 pages is written immediately after he is permanently settling in as Bonforth. The last 25 pages, I guess you could interpret this as still being... Yeah, I guess my criticism is the same, because he's still... he talks about Bonforth and I as separate. But he also talks about Lawrence Smith as separate from the great Lorenzo and Bonforth. So his identity is sort of confused at the end. Maybe that could have just been a little better articulated, I guess. But at least Heinlein's trying at the end. He does some interesting stuff with the pronouns and the names and the first person narration. Bonforth, Lorenzo, Smythe, I. They're all scattered throughout those last few pages, and it's not clear who's who, I guess. But in my reading of it, he is Bonforth at the end. And Bonforth hasn't really died, or like one avatar. It's like James Bond, right? Swapping actors or something. So anyways, good novel? Yes, yes. And it's a quick read. It's probably like 4 hours, maybe 5 hours at the most. You know, this is really like on a couple days commute, you can read this book with the audiobook. So I think next... There might be a short story. I have to look at my list. But I think at this point we just jump to 1957 and Citizen of the Galaxy, the second to last of the Heinlein juveniles. So, but I'll double check to make sure there's not a short story published in 1956. But I think our next episode will be probably, and again, I'll try to do it in one episode. Citizen of the Galaxy. So for the shorter novels coming up, I'm going to do it with one episode, like Citizen of the Galaxy, Have Space Suit Will Travel, and Dorne to Summer. At least those three will be one episode. Starship Troopers, maybe two. We'll see. Pod Kane, probably just one. But yeah, that's it for now. So it's really nice to slip into Heinlein, adult Heinlein for a bit, even though it's a very short novel. But it's a good warm-up for the adult novels we're going to get in the 60s, which I'm really looking forward to reading. I have read a couple, three of them, I think, before. Moon is a Harsh Mistress, Stranger in a Strange Land, and I Will Fear No Evil. But the rest, I haven't really read. And I think there's a lot there. What I've heard is, like, he gets really bad after the 60s and gets a little really weird. I'm looking forward to that, too. But for now, this has been really enjoyable. It's nice not to constantly be with these young kids novels, even though the next book we're going to read is once again a juvenile, but this was a nice break from it. And it's just a good story. It's a good, quick story, basically a novella, very compact, very, very tight, not much fat in here. It gets right to the point and it's pretty compelling throughout. Even though there's not like a lot of action and life in limbo kind of stuff, it's pretty compelling. And there's tension in here, political tension and drama. And a character you start hating and kind of end up liking. And as he becomes this politician, he's even more likable. That's good stuff. Really, really great. So this has been fun. Let me know what you think of Double Star. And I know there's another one, Burial Star, which I don't know if I'll do. I think that's a rehashing of some fragments posthumously published. But anyways, thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.